I've made this culpability presentation to many groups during the past years, and I've communicated with countless individuals about ways they can live well in spite of vision loss. During that time, I've witnessed a wide range of success rates. Some people are leading full and active lives, some are living well enough from day to day, and others have withdrawn into self-pity and bitterness. Some people seem to thrive as a result of their impairment. Adversity seems to bring out the best in some people, but why not everybody? Why does one person move on while another one gives up? And is it possible to change? I've come to believe that a person's attitude when faced with trauma is dependent upon what I call their culpability. Culpability involves making do. This means facing a situation and using the materials at hand to make the best of it, simply because there is no other sensible option. We're visually impaired. There's not much we can do about it at this time except to maintain our physical and our psychological health until the problem can be fixed. That means we have to make do with the materials at hand, which are low vision devices, technology, support opportunities, and adaptive solutions. These materials are plentiful and available, but it's up to us to gather them, and that's where our culpability comes in. I remember a conversation with a lady whom I'll call Millie. She told me, she said, "I hate trying to read menus in dark restaurants. Why can't they turn on the lights?" And I asked her if she had a lighted magnifier. She said, "Yes, but I can't use it." And I said, "Is it the wrong magnification?" Millie said, "Dead batteries." And I said, "Why don't you replace them?" She said, "Well, I can't get to the store." I said, "But you get to the restaurant." And she said, "My daughter takes me." And I asked her, "Could your daughter pick up some batteries for you?" And she said, "Well, I suppose so." And then I said, "Then you could read the menu." She said, "Yes." And then I said, "And the restaurant could continue to use nice, soft lighting." And she said, "I suppose so." Another case in point is Phil. He phoned me from across town. He said, "Dan, I can't see the television anymore." And I said, "Well, how large is the screen?" He said, "I can't afford one of those big ones." And I said, "Okay, where do you sit when you watch it?" And he said, "In my recliner across the room." And I said, "Have you tried binocular glasses?" "Can't afford them." "Well, if I get you some," I said, "would you wear them?" He said, "That hurt my nose." Well, I said, "Okay, have you tried sitting closer?" He said, "I can't move the chair, I got a bad back." So I said, "If I came over and move it, do you think you would that solve your problem for you?" He said, "Well, it might work. What would that cost me?" I told him it cost him a cup of hot tea. He said, "Don't have any tea." I said, "Do you have a cup?" He said, "Yep." I said, "I'll bring the tea. How about tonight?" He said, "You want to stay and watch the game?" And I said, "Sure." He said, "See you at 6. Well, we got him fixed. He was able to see the game just fine. We moved him right about 4 feet from the TV, and he's a happy man. So acceptance of personal responsibility is difficult enough. Then when disability enters the equation, the willingness to transfer responsibility to other people often magnifies. This was the position Millie and Phil found themselves in. The burden of low vision made the world a more difficult place, and they didn't recognize the power they had to make it better. That was a new way of thinking that hadn't occurred to them. While loss of sight can often bring insight, it can also skew a person's perspective if they're looking for answers in the wrong places. It's hard to accept that no one is to blame for our diminished vision. Not only is there nowhere to lay the blame, but the highly visual world we live in cannot, in all fairness, be expected to meet us much more than halfway. The restaurant provides enough light for Millie to reach your table and for most people to read by. Millie must then accept the responsibility for taking care of the personal needs beyond that. Phil owns a chair and a television. Companies offer low vision devices to help him span the distance between the two. If, however, current technology can't help, then Phil's challenge is to experiment with ways to solve the problem. He might enjoy listening to the game on a radio, for example, or he could simply move closer to the television, as we suggested. Why didn't he think of that himself? Well, because as a newly diagnosed visually impaired person, he was unaccustomed to thinking outside of the box and seeing the obvious. How did you do on the culpability test in your newsletter? If you were able to check up to half of the statements as applying to you on that test in your newsletter, you're doing very well. If not, I hope today's session will help to give you the strength to cope with the challenges you're facing. I hope it'll help you to answer these three important questions. Are you going to allow low vision or blindness to put the brakes on your life? Are you willing to look for workable alternatives to vision? And three, will you let visual impairment negatively impact who you are? I hope we get answers to those today, or at least get some good thoughts about it. And we're going to get that help from Mary J. Clough, the social worker at the Jewish Guild for the Blind in New York City.
Hello, everybody. First of all, I want to say thank you to Dan for letting us, for inviting us to do this program. It's wonderful to be with you. Let me tell you a little bit about the support groups that we run here, because I think one of the main teachings of Dan Roberts is his tenacity, adaptability, support, knowledge, the task of living with low vision, and support's the big one. And he has asked me today to talk a little bit about support and to talk about the value and the importance of reaching out for support and to allow yourself to interact with other people who are experiencing some of the same issues and how valuable that can be, because isolation and depression are two bugaboos that we really have to address, and before you can think about learning how to use new magnifiers and learning how to use new devices, you have to have a better frame of mind. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about our group, and then what I'm going to do is I spoke to my group on Monday, and I told them I was going to be doing this. And I said, how would you like to talk to these folks that I'm going to be addressing, the 500 people who are out there across the country listening to this? And so I asked them to talk about the group and their experience in the group and what they get out of it. And I wrote down some quotes, and it really stirred up some thoughts and some reflections, and I'll share those with you. If you look at Dan's culpability list, it's 30 items, and each one is I must say, it's well thought out and well presented, and each one is a topic that deserves reflection. It's actually kind of a life list that we could all benefit from considering. You know, we cope generally in the style we've always coped, and if you've managed before, you'll manage this too. But our coping styles vary tremendously, and, you know, people maybe think they have to tough it out, strong-arm their way out. But many seniors make the mistake of thinking they should strong-arm their way out of depression. Or worse, they think if they can't strong-arm their way out, there's something wrong with them. Worst of all, they think they just have to live with it. People often come to my office to talk about their vision. They say, well, I guess I just have to make the best of it. And then they set their jaws and cry and look away. The proudest people cry. They don't mean they have to make the best of being depressed. They mean they have to make the best of being depressed with low vision. So depression is also can negatively strain your relationships, your spirit, and your health. And one of the best coping mechanisms that there is, I think, and it's available to you, you either got to start a group if you don't have one, or you've got to find one for yourselves. And I know some of you live in senior residences. There must be a lot of groups out there. And I want to congratulate you on that. I'm going to share with you now some of the group comments. When I presented to my group on Monday that I was going to be doing this, I said, tell me about yourselves. Tell me about why you come. Why some of these people have been coming for years. Why do you keep coming? What is it that you get out of it? What is it you expected? Did you get what you expected? And finding some of the things that they talked about were really worth mining for discussion. One of the first, we have a lady in one of our groups. Most of my people are in their 80s and 90s. And there's a woman in my group who used to be a convener for the Black Panthers, the Gray Panthers, and she's also an ex-social worker and a lawyer. But she's in her 90s now, and she said that she finds the group comforting, which isn't a word that I had thought of, but she finds the group comforting. Someone else spoke about the terrific practical value. I would say that someone said, every time I come, I learn something from others. I personally bring articles in from the Internet for those who don't have access. I mean, and these are people in their 80s and 90s, and they're really, really smart. But they know now to talk about how to talk about what's happening in the world of science and research. They want to know everything about stem cells and what's going on in the research. And these are not people who are going to benefit from this research. This is one of the topics that comes up fairly often. I really want to know what's going on so I can tell my daughters, so I can tell my son. I can talk to them about risk factors. I can talk to them about, it's not going to help me particularly because I'm already worse than legally blind. But it's important that I know these things, and it's important that I share them with my, my kids, because we all know there's a tremendous lot of information pointing to a genetic implication in macular degeneration. Another thing we talk about is the differences. There's a kind of a funny thing that happens between people in groups where they want to compare. They want to compare their vision to somebody else's vision. They want to compare their reaction to treatment to somebody else's reaction to treatment. Making comparisons. We try not to make comparisons from one to the other. It's a great temptation. Somebody wants to know, well, how did you do? You've had two Lucentis injections. How are you doing? I had one. I'm not doing very well. And I want to know why you got some improvement and I didn't. The thing that comes out in these discussions is something that's probably scientifically pretty close to reality. This is not just one condition. This is a constellation of different conditions. And we're only talking about wet macular here. Another thing that people have to be reminded of is that about 90% of people who have macular have the dry variety. And so, but the people who come to my group primarily have the wet, and so they want to know what's going on in the research. One of the other comments was made was, it helps to hear how other people think about low vision. For instance, we had a very lively discussion in both of my groups about what does it mean to accept low vision. How, do we accept it? Is that a negative thing? Is it a positive thing? What does that mean? Does that mean we're resigned to it? Are we resigned in a positive way? Dan has all wonderful answers for all these questions, I know, but it's a very stimulating. These are the kinds of discussions that we have. Another woman spoke up on Monday and said, you know what, I feel free to vent. I can come in here and vent, and I can say things that I don't say to other people because I know I'm understood, and I'm not going to upset anybody by admitting that I'm angry, admitting that I'm sad, or expressing my emotions. One said that she would definitely encourage others to form a group. You've got to, it's helpful to have a leader, and I bet you have leaders there who would be willing to work with you if you don't have a group already. There may be a lot of groups out there. I don't know, so I'm just putting that out for you. One thing that came up on Monday was we need a place to find new friends. Now, I don't know if, as I say, my folks are all in their 80s and 90s and have lost a lot of friends. And this friendships have formed. People are in my groups are taking trips to museums. Yes, you can go to museums. Yes, you can go to the movies. Yes, you can read books and discuss them. We have a woman right now who's starting a book club. Everybody's going to listen to the same book, and then they're going to discuss it. But this business of finding new friends, because having social connections is one of the best things you can do for your culpability score, is making social connections. And if you've lost friends, you know there are a lot of losses associated with getting older. You don't need me to tell you that. But one of the main things that comes up that I hadn't even thought of until it came up in the group is a loss of privacy. Having to depend on other people to do things for you or to check on your finances or to, so there may be other ways to find to do it, but it's disconcerting sometimes to turn over your privacy because it's the way you control your life, turning over your privacy to other people. So we get to talk about that. We get to talk about how it feels when our kids get overly protective and won't let us travel. These people, for the most part, will travel. There are ways to accommodate themselves in airports. People have had very good experiences with traveling. As a matter of fact, one of the women on Monday said, you know, this whole experience of being with other people with macular has raised my confidence. People are afraid of a lot of things, and they're afraid of going out. Now, here in New York, we have a tremendous advantage because we have a lot of good public transportation. The buses here are run frequently, and they run all over the place. And unless you get a cranky bus driver, you have a lot of ability to get around. Let's see. This group, activities outside the group, they wanted you to know that if you don't have this available to you already, you might want to look into it. Museums, the museums here, the Metropolitan and the Museum of Modern Art, have special workshops for the visually impaired. And also, go to the movies. The only thing you can't do is read subtitles. And they talk about going to the movies. They talk about movies in the group. And sit down in the second or third row. Also, one of the things that comes out in our groups is humor, which is talk about culpability. If you can find humor in some of the things that happen to you, that's a real mark of your culpability. We had a gentleman who invited his son over for dinner one night, made a tossed salad. He was so proud of himself, he had prepared the whole meal himself after having taken a class in rehabilitation. And the son said, "Oh, the salad is a little bit chewy, Dad." He had tossed a green pot scrubber into the salad with the lettuce. So there's a lot of things. And I heard about another woman who made a cherry pie, only she made it out of red kidney beans. These things happen, and these stories come out in our group, and getting together and laughing about things is tremendous for your mental health and for your culpability. One of the topics that we talked about, and it brought up a discussion that lasted most of the whole group, is reflecting on the day they got the diagnosis of macular degeneration, what it meant to them, and how things have changed with groups, with group activities, with learning how to do new things, with learning how to use low vision devices, to using all those culpability suggestions that Dan talks about in all his wonderful work. Everything that they give you in the low vision department, a magnifier, a CCTV, a tape player for the talking books, there's a learning curve that you have to go through. And there are people who are fast people, and there are people who are slow people. And the thing that I hear very often from folks is the main word, the mantra is patience. Everything that you're going to learn to do in a new way is going to take you longer than it ever did before, and you're going to get very impatient. But give yourself time, because everything, it's you're learning new things, and there's a learning curve involved in everything that you're going to do, because you're going to find out different ways to do things and to substitute activities and to substitute devices. Please, I would urge you to take a deep breath and be patient with yourself. I'm getting close to most of what I put down here to share with you. Dan, do you have any questions? Is there anything you'd like me to touch on that I haven't mentioned?
I wanted to thank you very much. You covered every topic that I asked you to cover, and you covered it very well, and you actually stayed right on time. That's just amazing. That's why you're such a good group leader. You've reached a lot of people here today, every one of whom understands the importance of support groups, or they wouldn't be where they are. And, of course, we hope that many, many more retirement centers and low-vision libraries and senior centers will realize what we're doing here, and that we're able to hear wonderful people like you coming from all the way from New York right into our own rooms here to speak with us on these subjects. So I think you've done a great job, and I really appreciate you coming in today. So we look forward to seeing all of you again. We appreciate your interest and your support.